forever. Starts Friday.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Coming up today, we're talking about a variety of things. The price of housing is climbing, and for many, it's becoming much less affordable. There's a plan to tackle the housing crisis in a neighborhood in North Tampa. We're going to talk about that plan in a moment. And later, the U.S. has placed an aircraft carrier and bombers close to Iran in preparation for possible war with that country. We'll discuss Iran with a veteran CIA agent in the second part of the program today. But first, four listener comments about recent topics, including the possibility of war with Iran, arming teachers, and that 9/11 call from a Naples, Florida resident complaining about a Muslim comedian. Here's what four listeners had to say.
This is Kevin talking about war today on the program. I'd like to mention the fact that the first casualty of any war is the truth. I'm not sure how many people realize where the largest casualties lie when a war goes on. And this is for the people that are in favor of war and war with Iran and Iraq. It's women and children that wind up bearing the brunt of any war. And so if you think that that's a good plan to just go ahead and keep slaughtering innocent civilians, then yes, go ahead and keep beating the drum for war. The other thing I'd like to say is I think that we would do much better if we had the draft, because then I think a lot of this stuff would never even come to see the light of day if everybody's kids had to go serve.
This is Art from Largo. As one who has lived 16 years in the Middle East, when the U.S. with its allies attacked Iraq under George W. Bush, I told my wife that the next two countries would be Syria and Iran. I said this because all three were main enemies of Israel at that time. Well, two down and one to go. I think the main reason for the U.S.-Israeli invasion of Iran would be to destroy Iran's nuclear capabilities. Because two nuclear powers in the Middle East, Israel and Iran, would also create a stalemate among the two countries. Such a stalemate already exists between India and Pakistan, Russia and the U.S. So with this stalemate, America's major role in the Middle East would be reduced to a very minor one, which would be a great disadvantage to Israel. Therefore, I definitely favor two atomic powers in the Middle East for a greater chance for peace in the area.
This is Zach from Riverview. Just a thought that seems to keep getting skipped over. The whole good guy with a gun argument is just ignorant crap. Every bad guy was a good guy the day before. So all these shooters aren't born Dr. Evil. They snap. Also, I was a substitute teacher in Hillsborough County for a few years, and I'm not small. I'm like 6'4", 260, and there were a few times that I felt threatened. The important thing is you learn to deal with it non-lethally. Teachers with guns is a horrible idea. I mean, what are we teaching the kids? That every situation or every threat or every problem should be dealt with by lethal force? The gun is the only answer? I don't like where that's putting us.
A bill in Spring Hill. Hey, that skit you played yesterday with that 911 call was totally ridiculous. How long did he tie up an emergency line for something so stupid? I'm sure he doesn't have any problems sitting in front of his TV watching Jeff Dunham do his skit with Ahmed the terrorist. Anyway, thank you very much.
Well, there you have some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. There's no doubt that housing is becoming more affordable here in the Tampa Bay area. A recent study found that the average Tampa renter has an income of just about $35,000 a year. In the city of Tampa, that will get you an apartment of just a little over 600 square feet, which is the size of the closet in George Steinbrenner's mansion, which is now for sale in South Tampa. Here to talk about affordable housing and what one community is trying to do about it is Sarah Combs with the University Area Community Development Corporation. And Sarah Combs, welcome to WMNF. Nice to see you.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate being on the show.
So give us the big picture. How unaffordable is housing becoming? How big of a problem do you think it is?
Well, unfortunately, we are, you know, it's not just the community that I'm working in, which is the the university area community. It's Tampa Bay in general. I mean, we truly are in a unattainable housing crisis. And, you know, the challenge with that is that we can do so much better. The university area community specifically, you know, the average income there, like you said, is, you know, for us, it's under $30,000. We just took a survey specifically, and 50% of our residents make less than $15,000. And the average two-bedroom apartment is now going for $1,200.
How do they afford it?
So how do they afford it, right? You know, and then the problem and the challenge that we're having specifically in the university area community is that they are left with, you know, being challenged with landlords that are, you know, providing horrible conditions, and they're trapped there because there's not another option. And that's a big challenge in the community.
Tell us, where is the university area community in Tampa?
University area community is located directly outside of USF. And so that's the community that we've been working through the university area CDC for nearly 21 years to increase and improve the community with the residents.
Now, when I first moved here to Tampa, that was an area that there were a lot of students living in at the University of South Florida. Is that still true?
Not as much as it was before, and that's really where it took a dip and a change. It was predominantly built for professor and student housing, and then that all changed, and unfortunately we're left with the housing stock of duplexes, triplexes, apartment complexes, really little home ownership. We have about, in the community that we're serving, we have less than 9% home ownership, which is really the main root and cause of the transient nature of the community.
What kind of jobs are people doing, the people that live in the university area community? What kind of jobs are they? I've been reading about the University Square Mall, what used to be called the University Square Mall. A lot of shops there are closing. Were folks from the community working at the mall?
Absolutely. You know, folks from the community are working at, you know, there's a lot of small businesses in the university area community, and they've been working at those. But interesting enough, we just completed our community needs assessment that we do every 2 years, where it's beating the streets, getting residents to engage in a meaningful survey, about 75 questions. And the data that came back from that says that 65% of our residents are working outside the university area community. So, you know, that poses a lot of different challenges and obstacles, especially when about 50% of our residents don't have a car. So if you pair that and couple that with, you know, not being able to afford your housing and then having transportation that's challenging because we got two bus stops taken away in our community, and then you're working outside of the area, we can do better. We can do better.
So transportation is a big issue, but let's, and maybe we'll get to that, but let's talk about housing for a moment. So what are your ideas about providing a better housing situation, a more affordable housing situation for these folks who live in the area, whose incomes are under $30,000 a year?
Well, you know, for us, we have to make it make sense. And I think that the most important piece for us is to ensure that this community gets a chance to stay the community that it is, that the residents get an opportunity to stay in this community, especially with all of the growth and change that's happening outside the area, especially with the Innovation Partnership with Mark Sharp. He's doing a great job in that sense. And so I'm really partnering with his organization to say, how do we ensure residents, you know, get the opportunity to grow roots and stay here? And so we're looking at land banking. So we've been aggressively land banking property within about two years now, and we've acquired 20 parcels of property in the community.
What is land banking?
So land banking is acquiring land and then working with the community to figure out what the intended use is and really earmarking it for attainable housing. And attainable housing comes in all shapes and sizes, right? For me, it's really figuring out a product and a model that will work. One of the innovative solutions that we're focusing on now is modular housing. It can go up in 3 months, and the idea is to be able to make it affordable for residents and to really change the transient nature and let it be home ownership opportunity. Mm-hmm. And for this product, we can do that. It can be cheaper to have your own mortgage than it is to rent. And that's the bottom line. That's the goal.
Well, what is modular housing?
Housing is engineered and structured in a factory setting. Mm-hmm. It meets all the standards and codes and development codes that the county requires and can be assembled and put up within 3 months, ready to go for, you know, individuals in our community. So the two pilot programs, homes that we're working on through Titan Homes and working with CTV with Vince Jackson on these modular project. And so those two homes will be for single moms in the community. If we can show that this product will work and that we can do affordable mortgage, then we're looking at scaling it and doing more of that, because that will, again, home ownership is, you know, the opportunity that residents need in our community to grow roots and be able to, you know, obviously have income and have an additional revenue source at the end of the day.
And that's the beginning of building family wealth that you can hand off to the next generation.
Absolutely, that's the key. Yeah. But you know, we can't just stop there with single family home ownership. We have to look at multifamily properties as well. So we're partnering with Blue Sky Communities, Sean Wilson and his team, and building 118 units on 12th and Fletcher, and really looking at this plan through our holistic approach to community development. You know, not just one product, not just one service, but how can we really tackle attainable housing on multiple levels, bringing in multiple partners. Another partner that we're working with is Habitat for Humanity of Hills. We're building a 7-acre park in the heart of the community, and then across the street from the park, we've acquired 10 parcels of land that we then partnered with Habitat, and they're building 10 homes. So, you know, really looking at this and figuring out how can we create meaningful, positive change in the community, and also make sure that the residents are the ones that are really informing this plan, and they're the ones that are going to be having the opportunities for it as well.
Well, our guest is Sarah Combs. She's with the University Area Community Development Corporation. She's the CEO of that nonprofit, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I would imagine that if you've been renting, if your family's been renting for a long time, and then suddenly you get a home that you own, there's a whole list of issues that come with it that you might not expect having growing up maybe renting a house.
Absolutely, and that's critically important. And one of the pieces that we have to ensure that anyone that's a candidate for home ownership has went through, you know, these classes. We're partnering with Salitas House to be able to provide those home ownership opportunity classes, the financial accountability. What do you do when you're seed clicks, you know, making sure that they are educated, prepared, and ready to take on, you know, the important aspect of being a homeowner and can be successful at it, which is the most important.
And I imagine the other thing, too, is that if we had higher wages, I mean, right now the minimum wage is a little bit above $8 an hour in the state of Florida. And if that ends up being $320 a week, that's not enough to rent a house or an apartment.
Absolutely. You know, we have to figure out career pathways for the individuals that we're working with, and that's what we're doing. We're looking at the anchor institutions that are surrounding the university area community and creating agreements with them where we're training the individuals and then get them hired at these anchor institutions where, again, transportation is right there. If you're working there, you have transportation. Those are two huge barriers that are eliminating people from being successful. But we stick with them, and that's the important part. We make sure that we're continuing to give them certification and layering certification so that way we can help them move up the ladder and get better jobs and it be more attainable. And for us, you know, we need to set that example. So, you know, as an organization, we're a nonprofit, but we run our organization like a business because it is one. And we've raised our minimum wage to $12 an hour, you know, and I every year I want to do better. I want to do more because we know the families that are working in our community. I mean, it's very, very hard to be able to, you know, afford life, you know, in this community at that kind of a wage.
Well, let me ask you about that. So you've raised your own wage for the employees, a baseline wage to $12 an hour. What kind of changes have you seen, or how has that helped your employees? What have you noticed about raising the minimum wage to $12 an hour?
Well, our employees are amazing. So, I mean, of course, they're very appreciative of it. But I think it's more what we do, not internally, but externally, setting the tone and setting the bar for that, is to say, we can do better, you know, and we have to do this together. We can't, you know, just wait for the government to decide this is the minimum wage. You know, what is a living wage in this community? And we need to make sure that we're contributing to that and having these healthy conversations around that and making sure that we're holding each other accountable as well, because, you know, at the end of the day, we have to really rely on each other to be able to improve the community. And if we're not paying our employees a livable wage, then I just don't think that we're doing them justice.
Well, the path to building wealth, the path to having a better life, is to get those middle class jobs. And some of the biggest employers in the Tampa Bay area are right up there. The University of South Florida is there. The James Haley Veterans facility is there. Then there's a big hospital up in the region, lots of doctor's offices, lots of big hotels up there. Are they taking part? Do they help the residents of the university area community?
Absolutely. And those are the ones that we're working with right now. So, I mean, what I see is opportunity. I mean, this community has been forgotten about for so long. And if you really look at the amazing assets that surround this community, there's no reason that, you know, we have the health statistics that we do in this community, and we can do better. And I'm excited because we're starting to see measurable change happen. And that's because we're really focusing on, you know, listening to the residents and then reacting to what their needs are and then pulling in partners to help support that, bringing in partners who are doing what they're doing the best and letting them do that and letting them show how successful it can be when we work together, leverage resources, and not duplicate services.
How many people live in the area about?
So our focus area specifically is about 40,000 residents.
And that's huge.
That's our primary area. We definitely serve outside of that area in our secondary. But, you know, that's also the area that has one of the hardest crime statistics tracks in Hillsborough County, the lowest unemployment. So what a great sample to be able to figure out these programs, this innovative approach to community development, to see and measure and track, to see if we're really creating meaningful change, you know, on the level that we're looking to see. And if we can do this, we can model this in other communities in Tampa Bay and, you know, in Florida in general, really just to create healthy and safe, equitable communities for all.
Anytime you have poverty, you're going to have high crime rates.
Absolutely. It goes hand in hand.
Yeah. How'd you get into this line of work?
I have to say it's a calling from the good Lord. I've been with the organization for almost 9 years now. And when I drove into the community, you know, I saw the need, but boy, did I see the opportunity. And I just am, you know, so blessed to be able to do this job every day. I mean, it is just a blessing and so much fun. I have amazing staff, and the residents that we work with are just, I mean, their potential has not even been touched yet. I mean, they can do so much if we just give them access and opportunity. So it's a blessing to be able to work at the organization with the people we work with.
Have the Habitat houses been built?
Our first one is under construction right now on the corner of 20th and 138th. So we're really excited about that because, you know, as you start to drive into the community where, you know, 3 years ago, nothing was happening. You know, it was the same community as it was about 18 years ago. But now you drive in the community, you see land banking signs that are up. You see a park that's being built. You see homes being constructed. You know, you see change happening. And most importantly, you see residents interacting with each other and taking ownership for that. They're engaged. They're involved. We're listening from them. And we're really just pushing from behind and letting them really be the voice of the community.
While USF is growing up there in North Tampa, at the same time, the mall there, which was the big employer, the University Square Mall, is scaling back. Some of the big stores have closed. I know that the owners of the mall have thought about changing the focus from retail to something that includes office space and other kinds of ideas. But how important is it when the mall begins to close down, or some of the big stores close down in the mall, how does that affect the people in your neighborhood?
Well, you know, we're working hand in hand with RD Management, who are the owners of the University Mall, and making sure that, you know, they're keeping in mind the community along with this development plan. And so we're excited about the opportunities that, you know, I think this community will have if we make sure to keep them at the table. You know, as these plans are being developed, we're working with, you know, like I said, Mark Sharp, and we're also, you know, working with individuals at the mall to make sure that there's a plan for the community that goes alongside and complements with what they're doing. And that's where I think our community benefits agreement is going to be really key for this community. It hasn't been successfully done in Hillsborough County, and we're the ones saying we've got to do it. We've got to do this now to make sure that as new development comes in, like the mall with the $1 billion investment, how does the community benefit from that? You know, how do we can ensure that, you know, those construction projects that are happening, you have to hire from the community? How can we ensure that when you are putting in, you know, these big developments, that you're improving the infrastructure in the community, putting in sidewalks, putting in some, you know, some grass, some greenery. We want to ensure that residents, you know, have an equal opportunity to be able to succeed along with the, you know, community outside of us. And the community benefits agreement, we think, is the way to go.
So has the mall agreed as it changes and expands to hire local people for construction and some of the jobs at the mall?
Yeah, we're excited. We're in the talks right now with them. And, you know, so far all of it has been yes, yes, yes. So we're really excited about it, and hopefully we can get them to sign on the dotted line to make it official.
Well, Sarah Combs is the CEO of the University Area Community Development Corporation. It's in the area just west of the University of South Florida, North Tampa, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Your staff sent me some things ahead of time. I was looking at the number of people waiting for affordable housing. We have what's called Section 8 in this country, and that is where landlords take in low-income people under the Section 8 program. The waiting list for Section 8 in Tampa is long.
Yeah, it's beyond long. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's really, really sad. And unfortunately, this is the day and age that we live in. And, you know, there's just not adequate housing for all. And so we cannot build it fast enough. And so, you know, everything that we can do, you know, in terms of housing is going to be key and essential. So we're looking at, you know, how do we take the existing stock in the university area community that mostly is comprised of duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes? How can we take those, revitalize those, and create home ownership opportunities while we're also building single family homes and while we're also building multifamily units. We want to make sure that we're showing that this can be done, this can be leveraged through different funding sources, and we can make an impact in that. So right now we're looking at for multifamily rental, we're looking at doing about 240 units within two different, you know, project sites. And so, you know, that's impact for me, you know, that's impact. And then building homes, single family homes, you know, that's impact. We want to show that this can happen. But most importantly, how it can happen. And that's through the collaboration of the county. You know, you have to have the county support. You have to leverage outside funding sources, corporate dollars, individual donations, things of that nature. And to show that, you know, we really can do this and we can make the numbers work. We can create a model that can work in the communities that we're serving.
I was looking at some of the numbers. The waiting list for Section 8 has been closed since 2010.
Yeah.
So, and it's not going to reopen for several more years in Tampa.
Well, I mean, that just gives you an example, a perfect example of how bad the housing crisis really is.
In Hillsborough County, 200,000 families, that's 40%, pay more than 30% in housing costs in Hillsborough County. I mean, that's just amazing. What's happened, and that the wages are not keeping up with the price of housing.
Well, and I think that that message has been heard, which I'm excited about. You know, Hillsborough County Board of County Commissioners have pledged $5 million, you know, this year to go to affordable housing, and that's just out of the, you know, the local funding source. They just passed a motion a couple months ago that for next year it's going to be $10 million. So, I mean, now we're starting to really, you know, get that message clear. People are starting to believe that, you know, we've got to really focus more on this and think outside the box, too. Innovative solutions to attainable housing, not just the same thing we've been doing.
When the legislature, year after year, sweeps money out of the Sadowski Housing Fund, Trust Fund in Tallahassee and says, we're going to use it for other purposes, not for affordable housing, does that affect you?
Of course it does. You know, that's money that we could have used, you know, one family at a time. And, I mean, that's the way I see it, is the, you know, every dollar they take out of that fund is a family that could be, you know, be living in an environment that's beneficial to the entire family, you know. And so, it's just so challenging. I thought this year we were going to make it happen, you know, that we were going to get that funding, and sure enough, we didn't. So, you know, it's so, the Sadowski funds, it's so important to lobby on that every year. You know, we just, even though our voice hasn't been heard, we have to continue to do it year after year, and one day it will. One day it will be.
I know that there are a lot of jobs up there in North Tampa near the university area, but also a lot of the jobs are in the West Shore area. They're out at the airport. They're in downtown. How big a deal would it be to have a train line that went through the university area that provided a commuter service from North Tampa into downtown Tampa and West Shore?
Oh, it would be amazing. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, Commissioner Overman has been touting, so has Commissioner Kemp. We've been talking to them about that, and we're big proponents of that. You know, we can do better in transportation, and, you know, those lines are already going through our communities. Why don't we make them active and be able to connect them to, you know, the different parts of the community? So that way, you know, residents in our community, like I said, we already have 60% that are working outside of the area. You know, and the transportation is a barrier. The two different barriers in our community to being able to be successfully employed are transportation and childcare. So if we can focus more on what's already there, looking at an asset that is already there, I think it just makes sense.
And childcare these days is so unaffordable for most people.
It is, you know, and so we're looking at seeing if there's more that we can do with the Head Starts and the Early Learning Coalition that's working to identify different resources in the community. That's the next area that we really need to dig into and tackle, because it is a challenge. And, you know, our kids deserve to be able to have that early education at a young age, and it's proven to really help them along their growth line. So we want to make sure that, you know, we're partnering with the right people, and we're in conversations to do that now.
And you've got a meeting coming up June 20th to talk about some of these ideas?
Yes. Yeah, so June 20th is our Lunch and Learn. And if you're interested in learning more about the work that we're doing in attainable housing, you can come to our community center. We have a beautiful campus, and you can see a little bit more about who we are and what we do. June 20th at 11:30. The information's on our website, uacdc.org, and we'd love to have you as our guest.
Well, Sarah Combs with the University Area Community Development Corporation, thanks for coming on WMNF.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Nice to see you, Sarah. This is 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa. In just a moment, we're going to talk about possible war with Iran. We'll be right back. from the Talking Heads here on 88.5 FM. Where Iran's foreign minister said today that sanctions imposed by the Trump administration are unacceptable, but that his country is committed to the international nuclear deal that was signed during the Obama administration. On a visit to Tokyo today, Mohammad Zarif defended Iran's right to respond to the U.S. pullout from the nuclear deal last year and the imposition of sanctions. Zarif was quoted as saying a multilateral deal cannot be treated unilaterally. Recent days have brought allegations of sabotage attacks targeting oil tankers off the coast of the United Arab Emirates, a drone attack on a Saudi oil pipeline claimed by Yemen's Iran-allied Houthi rebels, and the dispatch of U.S. warships and bombers to the region near Iran. Saudi Arabia responded to Tuesday's drone attack with a wave of airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen's rebel-held capital, Sana'a. At the root of the recent spike in Persian Gulf tensions appears to be President Trump's decision a year ago to pull the U.S. from the multinational nuclear deal with Iran, embarking on a tough U.S. sanctions regime imposed on Iran, crippling that country's economy. Here to talk about it is Paul Pilar. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and an associate fellow of the Geneva Center for Security Policy. He retired from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community in 2005. Paul Pilar, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
So tell me, are we on the brink of war with Iran, do you think?
Well, certainly, you know, the risk of it is higher than it's been for some time, and I would see the particular scenario, if we did get to war, one, not so much of the intent by one side or the other, although I think Mr. Bolton, our national security advisor, would certainly welcome a war for one, but rather some incident spinning out of control. And certainly when you have the kind of brinksmanship that the administration is exercising right now with dispatch of additional warships and so on and so forth to go along with all the rhetoric, this has created an atmosphere in which it would be very difficult to defuse some incident. And let me just recall an incident in the past, you know, back during the Obama administration. Listeners may remember we had this incident where a couple of small craft of the U.S. Navy, because of a navigational error, strayed into Iranian territorial waters. And our sailors and their craft were held by the Iranians for about 24 hours. Fortunately, then we had a channel of communications at the foreign minister level between Foreign Minister Zarif, whom you just quoted, and then Secretary of State Kerry, and they got on the phone and they were able to defuse the situation, and we got our sailors back before the end of the day. If we had the same kind of incident occurring today, I'm afraid the result would be far different.
Do you think Iran is abiding by the nuclear agreement?
They have been certified to abide by it in repeated inspections and reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency ever since the agreement fully entered into force back in 2015.
When Iran said earlier this week that it now thinks it may have the right to begin resuming enriching uranium, does that mean that it is on the path to building nuclear weapons, or why does it want to enrich uranium, and how long would it take to reach the point where it could enrich uranium to used in nuclear missiles?
Well, we need to be very specific about exactly what Iran is doing or is threatened to do. What President Rouhani has already announced they are prepared to do right now is to exceed the agreed limits on stockpiles of low-enriched uranium and heavy water. Under the agreement, they can keep some of that stuff, but not very much. And the arrangement has been that when they bump up against the limits for each of those substances, they have to get rid of it somehow. And the way they've gotten rid of it is to export it. They send the heavy water to Oman, and then they can send the low-enriched uranium, mostly it's the Russians who can buy it. Well, one of the most recent moves the Trump administration made, it was just less than 2 weeks ago, was to say, we're going to apply sanctions on anyone who imports this stuff, low-enriched uranium or heavy water. So they basically cut off the main mechanism for Iran to stay under its limits. So this measure that the Iranians announced was basically saying, okay, we're doing what the administration, the Trump administration has told us we have to do. We're going to keep this stuff rather than exporting it. Now, Rouhani coupled that with the further statement, talking to the Europeans in particular, saying, if you don't make the economic side of this agreement work, in other words, to give us the trade and commerce that we expected to get under the agreement, and that situation doesn't get better within 60 days, then we're going to start doing other stuff. And here we're talking about possibly, you know, enriching uranium to higher levels. And it's only then that we really have to worry about a proliferation concern that would get them closer to a nuclear weapon if they chose to take that course.
How far away, conceivably, how much time would it take for them to be able to build a nuclear weapon, do you think?
Well, we spoke back when the agreement was under negotiation about breakout times. And the general agreement among the experts was, at the time the agreement was first negotiated, in other words, before the limits came into effect and before the Iranians had to comply with it by disposing of all the stuff they had to dispose of, they might have been within just 2 months, 2 or 3 months of so-called breakout time if they wanted to make a rush to build a bomb. As a result of everything they had to do under that agreement, the breakout time was extended to at least a year, and that's the situation we're in now. I think if the economic side of things doesn't improve, and per Rouhani's statement, they started going to enrichment to a level above the low enrichment, I think it would still take a matter of some months before we would even be talking about being within reach of having enough material for a bomb. So as of now, we're at least a year away. But I'd also like to emphasize there's no indication that that's the course that they would want to take. There are reasons for them to send a message by exceeding the limits of this agreement as long as the U.S. is in blatant violation of it, but that still doesn't mean they see their future as a nuclear weapon state.
Our guest is Paul Pilar. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community. Among his books, Negotiating Peace and Why America Misunderstands the World, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. I want to go back to ISIS for a moment. Could you tell me whether or not or what role Iran played in fighting ISIS in Iraq and in Syria?
Well, they played a very major role, and in Iraq, they played the biggest role, actually. Not just directly, but even more so by aiding and mentoring some of these militia organizations in Iraq that took the lead in fighting against the so-called Islamic State. And this was, you know, the biggest instance we've had in recent years. We had an earlier one in Afghanistan, in which the United States and Iran were fighting and serving in on behalf of the same purpose, and this was to defeat ISIS. Most of the heavy-duty work was done on the ground by the Iranian-associated groups, and then the United States contributed air power. Over in Syria, you know, it's been a little more complicated since you've had this bigger, multifaceted Syrian civil war going on. But the Syrian-Iranian alliance has been longstanding. Those two countries have been allies for decades. Dating back to when they were both major rivals of the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq. And Iran, along with Russia, of course, have been instrumental in assisting the Assad regime in all phases of that war, but including the part in which ISIS has been involved.
Because sometimes I hear conservative commentators kind of conflate Iran and terrorism, and you know, I think they're referring largely to Hezbollah and Hamas. But you know, are Hezbollah and Hamas allied in any way with ISIS?
No, not at all. I mean, they really are on opposite sides of sectarian and doctrinal spectra that matter at all. And that's you're rightly pointing to what is some of the most confusing parts of the rhetoric about terrorism in Iran. And we've just talked about how Iran was in the forefront of going against part of what is been the biggest terrorist preoccupation for us in the United States, which is to say Sunni Islamic extremists of the Al-Qaeda and ISIS type. And Iran has been very much on the opposite side of the spectrum, as have the likes of Lebanese Hezbollah.
So they've been helpful in that war. And just pulling back and getting the wider picture, is there a proxy war going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran? And was ISIS part of that proxy war? And is Yemen part of that proxy war?
Well, Yemen is the place where you can say that there's a, quote, proxy war, although there we ought to get more careful with our terminology as well. The Yemeni civil war got rolling for totally domestic reasons. It had to do with northern tribes that for years and years thought they were getting the short end of the stick as far as power and resources and so on were concerned. So there have been periodic rebellions, and most recently we've had this group of northerners, northern tribes called the Houthis, who have had more success. The Saudis and the United Arab Emirates then intervene in a big way. Yemen has become, it's often called the worst current humanitarian disaster, man-made humanitarian disaster we have right now, and that has been overwhelmingly because of the air war led by the Saudis and the Emiratis. The Iranians have provided some material aid to the Houthis. It has been very, very small in comparison to the far greater involvement in the war by the Saudi-led coalition. And indeed, you can't even say the Houthis are proxies of Iran. They don't follow Iranian advice much of the time. In fact, the most important and significant step that the Houthis took in the whole war, which was to capture the capital city of Sana'a, they reportedly did against the advice of the Iranians. Nonetheless, the Iranians will continue to provide a modest amount of aid because they're happy to see their regional rivals, the Saudis, bleed. Yemen has become kind of Saudi Arabia's Vietnam, and as from the Iranian perspective, that's just fine.
And getting back to ISIS, was ISIS in a way a proxy for Saudi Arabia?
I wouldn't say proxy. However, to the extent that the Sunni extremists in the form of terrorists, and it's really, in when we're talking about Yemen, it's more al-Qaeda types than ISIS, they have been on the Saudi-Emirati side of the lines. It's in southern Yemen, the part where the Saudi coalition has been in charge, that they have existed. The coalition has said they have tried to, you know, take some measures to bring al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the particular group we're talking about, under control. But in fact, in this case, the Houthis have been the most fervent opponents and enemies against the al-Qaeda types in Yemen through all this time.
Our guest is Paul Pilar. He is a Vietnam War veteran and a retired officer in the U.S. Army Reserve. His degrees are from Dartmouth, Oxford University, and Princeton University. Just getting back to the possibility of war with Iran, there were these allegations of sabotage attacks this week. Non-military personnel have been ordered out of Iraq. Non-U.S. military personnel have been ordered out of Iraq. We've sent U.S. bombers and an aircraft carrier to the region based on some unspecified threats. Our government isn't telling us much about what the nature of these threats are. What do you make of this talk? Were those ships sabotaged by the Iranians? And what do you make of these unspecified threats?
Well, anything we say on that score, of course, would be speculation. A couple of points. With regard to the sabotage of the ship, I mean, there are multiple possibilities here. Iran or allies of it might have been involved, or it might have been a black flag operation. I shouldn't say black flag operation because no one's claimed responsibility for it right now, but it could have been, shall we say, a provocation by someone who would like to stir things up and lead to exactly the kind of incident we were discussing earlier that could blow it up into a larger war. So you know, the potential suspects are too numerous to speculate about at this point. You can't eliminate the Iranians, but you can't eliminate foes of the Iranians either. I mean, with regard to the larger picture about what's a threat and what's not, you're right, we haven't really heard specifics. The way I interpret this is there probably are and some of this has come out in the administration statements, some movements of Iranian or Iranian-associated forces or materiel. And, of course, we ought to worry about that. But then the question is, are we seeing something that pre-shadows an unprovoked Iranian attack? Or are we seeing basically preparatory and defensive measures, which I would be surprised that the Iranians were not taking, given all of the incredible hostility being voiced from Washington and all of the saber rattling coming from Washington right now? You know, if I were advising the Iranian regime as an Iranian, I'd say, well, of course you have to take these preparations. You never know when, you know, some conflict might break out, and we have to be prepared to respond. And I have no doubt that the Iranians, you know, are doing some moving of resources around precisely for that reason. But they're not seeking a war, and I would take, this is one area we can't take his word on many things, but I think this is one thing where we can take the word of the Supreme Leader, as well as Foreign Minister Zarif, when they say Iran does not look for a war with the United States.
Do you think Saudi Arabia is cheerleading us into war with Iran?
Well, you know, it was former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates who once commented that Saudi Arabia would like to see Iran fought to the last American. I would not put it past the Saudis, particularly given all the challenges and difficulties that their de facto ruler, the young prince, Mohammed bin Sultan, is facing these days, including the war in Yemen, as well as all the bad press he got in the West with the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, to stir things up and perhaps through some kind of provocation stimulate a armed clash between the United States and Iran. That would have a number of advantages from Mohammed bin Sultan's point of view. Now, he would have to weigh against that other ways in which Saudi interests could be adversely affected, and the obvious one would be some of Saudi Arabia's own own oil exports might be interrupted if you had a war going on in the Persian Gulf region.
Now, one of the rationales for the saber rattling is that some people here in the U.S. say, well, we're doing it so that the Iranian people will rise up against their government and complain about the money that Iran is using on its military and say it ought to be using this money at home. Iran has this vast oil wealth. And some people here in the U.S. who are in favor of the saber rattling say we're just trying to stir up those pro-democracy forces at home in Iran. What do you think about that idea?
Well, the reporting from observers in Iran that I read leads to a much different conclusion, that the main effect of the severe sanctions has been to hurt the way of life of ordinary Iranians and to increase the extent to which ordinary Iranians tend to place the blame on us more so than their own regime. Now, they have very legitimate reasons to blame their own regime for a lot of economic mismanagement, which also, in addition to the sanctions, is a cause of their economic problems. But the more we get out in front as an obvious cause of those problems, the more that those sentiments are going to be directed negatively toward us and less toward their regime. Beyond that, I mean, I just don't see Iran in anywhere close to a pre-revolutionary situation. The Iranians, the Iranian Revolution, you know, it's 40 years ago, but it seems like just yesterday in imperial Persian terms. And also, the Iranians have seen the mess that has been left with Arab Spring uprisings in places like Libya and Syria, and they don't want to go through that themselves. So no, you know, regime change obviously is an objective of people like Mr. Bolton and Mr. Pompeo, but I don't see this technique working.
Our guest is Paul Pilar. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and an associate fellow of the Geneva Center for Security Policy. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. No doubt that the leadership in Iran has had some very harsh things to say about Israel. Do you think that the people of Iran share the kind of harsh things that have been said about Israel over the years by Iranian leaders?
Well, I think many of them probably share sentiments that are shared throughout much of the region among the Arab population of the Middle East, which is to say, you know, resentment over treatment of the Palestinians, even though in the case of Persian-Iranians, they don't have the ethnic identity with the Palestinian Arabs that the other Arabs do. And certainly, as in any country, you know, official regime rhetoric is going to have an additional effect beyond that. So I think, you know, if you took a poll right now about attitudes toward Israel, you'd get very high negatives among the Iranian population. And the reason would be a mixture both of that genuine and fairly well-informed sentiment with regard to the Palestinian issue and also the effects of the regime propaganda. You know, I once had the opportunity to meet with the former president, Ahmadinejad, when he was in New York for one of the General Assembly sessions, and I was in a session where a few of us basically had the chance each to pose one question to him. And you recall his rhetoric was really, really hateful and bad in many respects, but especially about Israel. And the question I asked him was, why do you keep saying these awful things about Israel? You know, can't you see, even just from an Iranian point of view, that it doesn't do your country or your regime any good? And I got kind of a non-committal answer saying, yeah, you've got a point there, something along those lines. But his rhetoric continued to be pretty bad.
We're getting a lot of emails and a lot of phone calls, and we're almost out of time. But let me read some of the emails first. We might be able to squeeze in one phone call. But this is from Ken, and I think Ken's in Boston. Ken says, there's a big difference between the Sunni and Shiite religions. The Saudis are very strict as far as the interpretation of their Quran. And it's very different from the Iranians. They're actually Persians, as you pointed out, Paul. Ken goes on to write, the Iranians can be reasoned with, even though they have an overlay of religion and politics. I don't really believe they are a threat. My background comes from the Fellowship of Georgetown, and I lived in the country for 3 years as a contractor, and I actually trained the groups of the army in management because they sure had bought helicopters. And anyway, so apparently he was helping train helicopter pilots or helicopter mechanics over there. But he says the Iranians can be reasoned with. That's Kent's bottom line. What would you say?
Well, of course, we always should be careful about staying away from national stereotypes of one sort or another. I think as far as the leadership is concerned, yes, we can certainly reason with them. And I think there's a lot backing that up with regard to the larger population, much of which is very well educated, is quite well informed, and many of these things we've talked about in terms of the realities of strategic relations and so on. Yes, I would agree very much. And the other side of the observation had to do with the religious doctrine that underlies the Saudi regime, and there, although which is not to say there aren't reasonable people in Saudi Arabia as well, there clearly are. It is true that a major ideological underpinning of the more radical and violent forms of Sunni Islam that have manifested themselves in the likes of al-Qaeda and ISIS do have roots in the very intolerant Wahhabist brand of Sunni Islam that has been basically the state religion in Saudi Arabia.
Now, here's another email. This is from Simon. He says, Rob, where would you want to live and have WMNF broadcast from, Israel or Iran? Let me change this question, Simon. Let me say to Paul, where would we rather have exercise our free speech? Would we try to exercise it more in Saudi Arabia, or would we try to exercise it more in Iran? Paul?
Oh, well, I think of it depends on the topic, obviously. Looking at some of the most recent uses of state power in Saudi Arabia, in which some dissidents have been treated quite harshly, my immediate response would be I don't think I'd want it to be in Saudi Arabia. That being the case, one also has to note that in Iran we've had plenty of instances of harsh treatment of dissidents, and some of the political opposition leaders have been subject to house arrest. So in neither country are we dealing with anything close to liberal democracy as we know it. You know, as far as political rights are concerned, there are certainly more of them on the Iranian side, despite the grave imperfections in their form of democracy. They do have elections for a president and a legislature that matter, whereas there's nothing remotely resembling that in Saudi Arabia.
So a lot of people these days are saying, look, we don't want to be snookered again like we were in Iraq, that it turns out that the reasons that the Bush administration put forward in 2002, 2003 for going to invade Iraq all turned out to be false. And then the cost of the war to the U.S. and to the Iraqi people has been so huge. A lot of people, even I think President Trump during the campaign, the 2016 campaign, suggested that that war was wrong. How do we avoid making the same kind of mistake that we did in 2002-2003?
Well, it's incumbent on all of us, private commentators, media, and particularly our members of Congress, to be as critical and careful in scrutinizing, you know, whatever case is presented by the administration of the day, and somehow to not get swept up either in an atmosphere of belligerence and war fever or in partisan politics, where the natural tendency, of course, is to, you know, support leaders in your own party. That's a difficult wish list right there, but it's something that that has to be aimed for, and I'm encouraged by at least some of the voices in Congress I'm hearing, both on the Democratic side, and I would also say, you know, on the libertarian right, people like Senator Paul, and I hope to continue to hear their tough questions being asked.
Paul, if people want to see your writing online, where's the best place to look?
Most of my things are published in a couple of places. One is loblog.com, and the other is The National Interest.
All right, and The National Interest being, that's a conservative publication, right?
Well, you know, it's published by the Center for the National Interest, and which was used to be called the Nixon Center, because Mr. Nixon was involved in establishing it. And it does have more of a Republican identity, but they are tolerant enough to give space to things I say which are not most of the time pro-Republican.
Well, Paul Pilar, thank you so much for spending all this time with us. Great to have you here.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. That's Paul Pilar. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and an associate fellow of the Geneva Center for Security Policy. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community. He is a Vietnam War veteran and a retired officer in the U.S. Army. His degrees are from Dartmouth, Oxford University, and Princeton University. Among his books, Negotiating Peace, Terrorism, and U.S. Foreign Policy, Intelligence and U.S. Foreign Policy, and Why America Misunderstands the World. Well, you've been listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the Midpoint Program with the Surly Feminists. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. This is the Bay Area's community radio station, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. Bill Grace has been our phone producer today. Stay tuned for the Midpoint Program. It's coming up next. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for listening. Here's the latest news from NPR.